Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with one of the premier environmental journalists of the English language, author and commentator Mark Hertzgard. His latest book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Mark, you have said we have to stop climate change, but we also have to live through it. How are we going to do that? What strategies would you offer our listeners to adapt to the big changes that are coming?
Well, that's a tough one, Alex. That's the whole focus of that book, Hot, so it's hard to crystallize it into a few words, but I'll say a few things. First, that book is 80% about solutions. You know, we know what the problem is now, so let's really get focused on the solutions. The smartest thing I heard, and this came from leaders all over the world, not just in the Netherlands, but also here in the United States, there are some impressive people, and in Britain, those are the real leaders on this, that our goal has to be to avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. So there's two parts to coping with climate change now. On the one hand, we have absolutely got to, as we discussed earlier in this broadcast, keep the temperature rise at a minimum. We have to avoid unmanageable amounts of temperature rise. We cannot survive a 4°C temperature rise on this planet. So we've got to do everything we can to get off of fossil fuels and halt deforestation and change our agricultural system. And by the way, there's a lot of very good things happening there. Don't believe this nonsense that, oh, we can't do it. And for that, I refer listeners to what's going on in Germany. And there's a new book about the, as they call it in German, the Energiewende, which is the energy turn, the big turn that Germany is making. They are leaving behind fossil fuels. And by 2030, all of their electricity will be coming from non-carbon sources. And that, by the way, comes from the third biggest economy in the world's leading export nation, the economic superpower of Europe. The Germans have decided to do that. And by the way, they're being led by a center-right political party now. So this is not a left-right political issue. So that's the first thing. But then, getting to the core of your question, the other challenge is we must manage the unavoidable. Even if we keep temperature rise to 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, there's going to be a lot of impacts. Look at the impacts we're already seeing today with only 1 degree of rise. Hurricane Sandy, the terrible floods in Pakistan a year and a half ago that put 14 million people out of their homes. 14 million people in one of the most conflict-prone and nuclear-trigger-happy regions of the world. So we've got to prepare for that. And the ways to do that are many, but it will take money. And it takes social organization. We've got to manage the unavoidable. And there are things that you can do, even in one of the happiest and most uplifting parts of Hot, told the story of how some of the poorest people in the world, farmers in Western Africa, are already adapting to climate change. Even though they don't know that term, they're adapting to climate change by planting more trees and bushes in their fields, and that is increasing their productivity, agricultural productivity, because when you plant trees and bushes, it means that your fields are relatively cooler because of the shade, and it means that your soil is able to absorb what little rain they get there instead of the rain flashing off. So there's many things you can do. The Dutch, of course, are the world leaders in this. They have been building sea defenses and river dikes, but also changing how they govern themselves. And one example that I tell in the book Hot was how they had decided, okay, we're going to be getting more downpours, but also more drought. So what are we going to do? Well, they decided that they would take this area that was now a huge field. I went out to look at it, and they were going to turn it into a lake. And so this lake, when the River Rhine was overflowing, the flooding would be contained by diverting that water into this field and turning it into a lake. And then that water would then be available for drinking and so forth. In the event of drought. And I said to the government official who's leading me around, I said, well, that all sounds very well, but look, here's all these farmers who have this land. What about them? And he said, oh, don't worry. They will be bought out. We'll give them a fair price for their land, and you know, they'll be fine. And I said, well, what if they don't want to be bought out? And he looked at me as if that were a very American question, which it was. And he said, we have discussed this issue repeatedly over 4 years, from the local level to the regional level to the national level and back down again. It has been decided that this is what we need to do. And at the end of the day, you cannot allow two or three people to get in the way of what is good for everyone. And that, Alex, is what I mean about social capital. That ability for a society to realize that, no, we have to do what's best for all of us, that collective action is going to be necessary in these cases, and a transparency, a democratic process to be sure, but in the end, you act. And contrast that to other places I went for this book, like in Louisiana and Florida, which are, of course, prime targets for hurricanes, and where that sort of action is literally inconceivable because of the sacred nature of private property in those political and cultural contexts. You know, in Louisiana, they did not even have a building code. They did not have a statewide building code prior to Hurricane Katrina. And why not? Well, as was explained to me, because that would be socialism. You're talking about government planning, that's socialism. Well, of course, it's nothing of the sort, but that's the kind of difference that is going to be very problematic, frankly, for Florida and a lot of the American South that still holds to those ideas about the individual and government is always bad. Although, isn't it funny that, you know, when you get hit, then suddenly the opponents of big government suddenly change their minds. You saw this with Representative Peter King of New York lambasting the Republican leadership for ignoring and failing to take a vote right after the fiscal cliff stuff to give Hurricane Sandy relief. You know, when it's their people that are getting hurt, oh, then it's unconscionable that big government doesn't step in. When it's other people, you know, they're on their own. You know, we got that big deficit we got to worry about. So that kind of attitude is something that is very troublesome, I think, for the United States. And so for listeners, I would say that, you know, you want to make sure that your community is a community that works together, where people are closely knit and checking in on one another, and that you've got a government that works and that is willing and able to tax itself responsibly, prudently, and deliver on those taxes. But that's what we're going to need, is a lot more of that kind of effort going forward.
Well, Mark Hertzgard, where can people find out more about this book and about your ongoing writing?
Very simple. I have a website, markhertzgard.com, and I'll just remind folks it's a double A, as my Norwegian ancestors would be proud to say. And people who are interested, you know, you can buy Hot there and any other place. But I'd also just put in a quick plug as well for a group that I'm trying to start with some others called Climate Parents. And we're trying to organize parents and, for that matter, grandparents to finally speak out and get active on climate change. We find it just baffling that, given the stakes for what all of us hold most dear, which is our children, and, you know, my daughter Kiara is why I wrote Hot, it's astonishing to us that parents have been so quiet for so long about climate change, and we want to change that. And if you'd like to join us, please go to climateparents.org and let us know.
Well, you've hit me. I'm a parent, and I really care about what happens to my kids, and I'm hoping that'll be a wave that spreads around the world. We have been lucky to spend some time with one of the power minds on climate change, investigative green journalist Mark Hertzgard. You can read his columns in The Nation magazine and in many others. Mark's latest book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Find his website at markhertzgard.com, and I'll put links to this interview in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Mark, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Are there more floods? Is it climate change? Our guest is Robert M. Hirsch, a well-known research hydrologist and high-ranking water expert for the United States Geological Survey. Dr. Hirsch, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Robert, there is more concern about flooding, and I was surprised to find there's another whole community dealing with the year-to-year reality of floods in the United States. Most of my guests are climate scientists, but how would you characterize the differences between the climate community and maybe the civil engineers and flood planners on the ground?
Well, in the hydrologic community, civil engineers, flood planners, etc., we're trying to take a look at the question of flood hazards in general, which is really a combination of things that may be going on with the climate, things that are going on in the particular watersheds, and what's happening along the floodplains. And I want to just point out right off the bat that I'm not at all talking about coastal floods. Those are a very different kind of phenomena having to do with oceanic storms and sea level. I'm really talking here about river floods. And what we see is that if we look at watersheds where the effect of human activity in the watershed is relatively minimal, that is to say, no large amounts of urbanization, no dams of any substantial size, that by and large, we don't see much of a change in the size of the floods that we get really over the last century or so. We see some areas of decrease and some small areas of increase, but taken as a whole, we don't see a great deal of change.
All right. Well, we're going to take some time to develop that idea further. One of the terms you use, which few of us know, is stationarity. What does it mean, and why is it important for water management or climate?
Right. Stationarity is a statistician's term that has to do with the idea that there's a probability distribution of certain kinds of events, in this case, a probability distribution of floods. And the assumption of stationarity is really the assumption that the floods that we get in any given year come from the same distribution that they did in the past, that the mean value, the standard deviation, et cetera, haven't been changing over time. And all of the methodologies that civil engineers and others use to design for things to protect people against flooding, whether it's laying out flood zoning areas, to build flood walls, to design dams, spillways, et cetera, are really all based on this assumption of stationarity. And it's very important that we look at the question of, do the data suggest that we're departing from that assumption of stationarity, or are we not at this point?
Right, because if we were departing from it, that might be a signal of climate change. Is that what we're getting?
That's right. But in a lot of cases, it could also be a signal of things that are happening within the watershed, for example, urbanization and land drainage and other things that people do on the landscape. So there's a multitude of possible reasons for non-stationarity, climate change being just one of them.
All right. Well, I've been in correspondence with Dr. Jeff Bonin at the National Atmosphere and Ocean Administration. He, like you, is very cautious about assigning a big role for climate change in the remarkable floods we've seen in the past 3 years or so. I'm thinking of the Mississippi floods in the spring of 2011. It was one of the worst recorded in the past century. Or the strange 2010 flooding of Nashville. Do you think these extreme floods are signs of climate change, or is it something else?
I think any given event can never be demonstrated to be a result of climate change. You have to really look at a preponderance of data and seeing over a large number of locations and over a large period of time that we're seeing a change in this probability distribution of floods. And so a few particularly unusual incidents really don't give a clear demonstration of that. The other thing I would point to is that when we look at very long records, and when I say that, I'm talking about 100 years, 120 years, which are about as long as any of our gauge records go, there are a number of places in the country where we see very long-term variability. And I'll use the upper Mississippi River Basin as an example. It also applies to places like the Red River of the North in North Dakota and in Minnesota, and that is that during the late 19th century, some of these areas had extremely large floods. Then during much of the 20th century, up until the last two or three decades of the 20th century, the floods were much, much smaller by and large. And then they've come back to, we're seeing sort of a clustering of some fairly large events. And when we look at it in that perspective, seeing that we had high and then we had low and then we had high flooding events, it really brings into question the idea that this could be greenhouse driven, because clearly the greenhouse gas increase is a fairly recent phenomenon, mostly in the last 4 or 5 decades. So that it brings up the idea that there are some very long-term, what I call quasi-periodic oscillations in the climate system. People have heard of El Nino and Atlantic Oscillation and some of these things, which are examples of quasi-periodic oscillations causing either wetter conditions or drier conditions or warmer or cooler, and they last for some particular period of time. But I think it's also recognized that some of these kinds of oscillations can last for decades or even centuries. And maybe the classic of all of these oscillations is the ice ages, which came and went over periods of hundreds of thousands of years, obviously with no influence of man causing them to come or go. So I think we have to be kind of recognize that there are some major oscillations that occur that can be driving floods, as well as the possibility that climate change could be driving changes in flooding.
All right. Well, why don't you tell us just a bit more about some of the other human factors that can lead to extreme floods that aren't climate related?
Absolutely. The most well-known and well-understood of these phenomena is in urbanization and the building of streets, sidewalks, rooftops that drain to those streets and sidewalks, and all these things that make much of the land surface relatively impervious and that the rain that falls on it runs off very, very quickly and creates much larger floods. And this is a phenomenon that's been well known and well documented for many decades and can result in doubling or even quadrupling or even greater increases in the size of floods that one sees in these kinds of watersheds. And in many cases, communities, neighborhoods that say were located along beside a stream that may have been relatively safe from flooding in the past now become very, very susceptible to flooding because of these changes in the drainage system, in the pavement, et cetera, that lies upstream. So this is a very, very big cause of increased flooding. There's another cause which has to do with constraining the river channel between levees or flood walls, which is often used to protect communities in the floodplain. This can have the effect of causing the flood to move more quickly down a river and therefore sort of concentrate itself in areas that are located more downstream. The floodplain of a river, that is to say the flat area typically on both banks of a river, is a very important sort of natural storage device that will naturally attenuate the size of floods. If we don't allow that floodplain to operate and store the water and also allow some of that water to infiltrate into the ground, it can increase the probability of flooding or the size of flooding that occurs downstream. So those are two of the things that are big factors. Other factors that are a little harder to pin down in terms of what their impacts are things like wetland drainage and other forms of drainage like agricultural tile drainage, which have an effect that's somewhat like that of paving over the land surface because it creates a more rapid and direct conduit for the water as it comes down in precipitation to ultimately reach the stream. So this can be another factor, but it's a little harder to identify and estimate how large those consequences are.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the award-winning and much-published water expert, Dr. Robert M. Hirsch. He's with the United States Geological Survey. Well, I'm sure, Dr. Hirsch, one of the questions my listeners are asking themselves is, are we seeing more flooding in America than in the past? Can we answer that question?
First of all, I think it's very important that people recognize the distinction between flooding as a sort of a physical phenomena as measured by the amount of water moving down a river versus measuring the damages associated with floods in terms of property losses or even loss of life. Property losses from flooding have definitely gone up in recent decades and seem to be continuing to go up. But a lot of this is associated with more and more people living in harm's way along the floodplains of our nation's rivers. Strictly as a phenomena of how much water comes downstream, we can say a couple of things. If we look at most of the western United States, west of the 100th meridian, which would be a line, a north-south line that would run through about Bismarck, North Dakota, let's say, all the way down to Texas. To the west of that, by and large, we're seeing actually floods are getting smaller over the last decade. That doesn't mean in every location they are, but in quite a number of them are, particularly in the Southwest. And this actually may be related to climate change, and it means because of having smaller snowpacks in the mountains, which in those snowpacks are really a potential source of flooding when they get hit with a warm rainfall event, let's say. Looking more to the eastern part of the United States, there's a couple of areas that seem to be showing some increases. One of them is an area that runs from, let's say, Fargo, North Dakota, on down into parts of Iowa and the upper Midwest, that certainly have had a cluster of very large floods in the last, say, since the 1970s and up pretty much to the present. But I should also add that that's an area that saw very large floods in the late 19th century, so it kind of confounds the story. One other area is New England, kind of running from the Catskills outside of New York City and on up through New England, does seem to be showing some increase in the frequency and magnitude of large floods. But for the rest of the eastern part of the country, looking at many stream gauges that we have that have very long records, it's really kind of a random scattershot of some that show increases, some that show decreases, and we would say that it's really nothing more than you would expect by chance alone. So that's kind of the story that we see. We think it's important that it be continue to be monitored and continue to be checked, because we think it's important to understand if those changes are afoot and to be able to develop an ability to predict how they'll change so people can adjust to the kind of flooding that they may face in the future as climate changes.
Well, should cities be upgrading their stormwater systems or their dikes or other flood defenses?
In general, I think one of the things we've learned in recent years is that there's a lot of uncertainty about the size of floods that one can expect in any given area. And that uncertainty comes because you can go through long periods of relatively small floods and think you don't need to build that infrastructure very large, and then encounter a period of large floods. So adding more of a safety factor, I think, can often be important. But I don't think we have the science in hand at this point to tell people what those design changes need to be. I think there are some other reasons to look at urban drainage design, whether it's our rooftops or our lawns or our streets or our sidewalks. And that really has to do with water quality, and that the runoff from those areas in through our storm sewers and eventually into our rivers can be a source of considerable pollution. And in areas like resolving problems of Chesapeake Bay's water quality or Lake Champlain or Long Island Sound and a whole variety of places, that changing our design of our urban infrastructure so that it captures more of the water and stores it and really keeps it on the landscape rather than letting it run quickly to the rivers has a lot of merit just because of the things that it will do to help our water quality.
Could you talk to us just a bit more about some of the work that you have done trying to sort out what is unusual weather and what could be climate disruption?
My focus is on the flood phenomena itself, as opposed to trying to look at the things that are happening in the atmosphere that create it. I think that's a very important job, to look at what's going on in the atmosphere, but I think it's also important to sort of look at the floods themselves. And we did a little study that we published a couple of years ago, my colleagues and I at the USGS, where we took these very long stream flow records and we asked a very simple question: are the size of the floods that we see at these locations, and there were about 200 of these sites spread all over the country with very long records, and we said, does there seem to be some correlation between the size of the floods and the amount of greenhouse gases in the global atmosphere? And that by looking at the collection of these many sites and the potential relationship, we hoped to be able to see if there was a connection between the two. It's a little bit like medical people doing epidemiological studies. They're not so much focused on what happened to this one person and why did they get sick, but rather to look at an environmental factor. In the case of epidemiology, it might be, say, smoking and the incidence of disease. We're looking at an environmental factor, which is greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and a consequence, which is flooding. And in a general way, we found really no strong association at a national level. And when we looked regionally, the only place we saw a strong association was in the Southwest, where it was a negative relationship. That is to say, the more greenhouse gases, the smaller the floods. So that's what we did. And we have some more studies being planned to look at the data in a variety of other ways to see if we can, the way I like to call it, is see if we can tease out the signal. Because I think ultimately climate change will have some effect, but it's not even entirely clear what that effect might be, what even the direction of the effect might be. And it might be quite different in different parts of the country.
Well, one thing I've noticed about your work, you emphasize the unique properties of each watershed. Do you have a favorite river you like to visit and study?
I have several. I'm fascinated by the Red River of the North, North Dakota and Minnesota, because it's undergone such an enormous change in the flooding phenomena over the last few decades. And there's a lot of competing arguments about why that might be taking place, including the nature of the farming and the fact that the landscape is still rebounding somewhat from the retreat of the glaciers. It's one of the flattest places on the face of the earth, and it's very hard for the water to get out of there.
I'm wondering, is there something that I've missed or anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, one of the things, and it's interesting, some people hear my message and come to the conclusion that I'm a climate change denier. And I think it's important to try to be more clear about this particular point of view, and I'm not the only one that holds this particular point of view. I'm not at all a climate change denier. I believe that there's a lot of things that we can see and a lot of things that the climate models seem to be doing a reasonably good job of predicting about changes. And mostly those are about changes in temperature, and particularly about changes in temperature in high latitudes, say near the North Pole or places like Alaska or northern Canada. But what I'm skeptical about is whether our understanding of the climate system is good enough to understand how these changes in greenhouse gases affect the water cycle and affect particularly how they affect storms. And when I look at the output of the climate models and how they would describe things that have already happened over, say, the last 100 years, because the models can be run in what we call hindcast mode, in other words, looking at the actual changes in greenhouse gases that have taken place and then simulating what kind of climate changes we might see over the preceding century. The models can do a pretty good job with temperature in general, but they don't seem to do a good job of describing things relating to water. And I don't mean that to just be a put down on the climate scientists. This is a very, very difficult job. And the point I'm trying to make is we probably don't have in hand today in the scientific community the predictive tools to describe what will happen to water as a consequence of climate change, even though we do have tools to describe a number of other things about our environment.
We've been talking with Robert M. Hirsch, a career water expert recommended by other experts. Dr. Hirsch, thank you for spending time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find links for this program at our show blog. That's at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening, and tune in next week as Radio EcoShock takes on the world.